Welcome to the West Virginia Soccer Association Beyond the Pitch podcast here on the West Virginia Soccer Association Digital Network. My name is Marcus Cole. Now, before we begin today's podcast, I just wanted to remind you that once you've had a chance to check out our program, make sure you give our podcast a 5-star rating and make sure you follow us wherever you get your podcast. That helps you stay up to date on all the latest content from us and helps us get the word out to others and let them know that we're providing valuable information for soccer players, coaches, referees, and parents. On the phone today, making his second appearance here on the podcast, is Connor Harris, Certified Strength and Conditioning Coach. Connor, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back. I'm excited.
Now, our subject today is something that I know that you feel very strongly about. You tweet about it a lot. You have some wonderful opinions about it and beliefs about it. And I figured it's a great subject to talk and get really dive right into. At some point in a soccer player's career, we deal with hamstring issues, whether it's pulling a hamstring or tweaking it or the proverbial, oh, my hamstrings are tight, which I know that you have some great thoughts about that. So I figured we'd dive into that today, if that's all right.
Sure. Yeah. Where would you like to start?
Well, let's go ahead and start from the beginning. And why don't you just tell us a little bit about what exactly is a hamstring?
Sure. So your hamstring is primarily concerned with pelvic control. So it's going to be a primary sagittal plane-based muscle, meaning the sagittal plane is basically like movements that are forward, back, up, and down. So if we think about our pelvis and how it's kind of like a bowl, your hamstrings are responsible for pulling that bowl backwards. Or imagine like spilling water out of the back of the bowl. And then your quads on the other side would be responsible for pulling the pelvis forward and like spilling that water out the front of that bowl. That is the pelvis in this example. So when it comes to just general human movement and human posture, like humans are different, like everyone's different, but we're not that different. And we all tend to default into certain predictable patterns of dysfunction, for lack of a better term, or postural malalignment. And that typically occurs through the quads becoming too powerful or too tight, so to speak, and they pull the pelvis forward, so the water is spilling out the front of the bowl now. And because of that, your hamstring could become lengthened. But when people think about a tight hamstring, they think they need to stretch their hamstrings. But in reality, the overwhelming majority of the time, it is due to your hamstring being too tight because it's being pulled on from both attachment sites. It attaches at the base of the pelvis, so on the lower end of that bowl, and it also attaches kind of near the back of your knees. So if you were to imagine that bowl spilling out water in the front so much that it's like a rope being pulled on from both ends, that's what goes on when someone has a tight hamstring, but they think it's a tight hamstring because it's short. But that it would be counterintuitive to try to lengthen out an already lengthened out muscle, if that makes sense. So that's kind of a general overview of what the hamstring does, why it's important, and what happens when we think of a tight hamstring.
Now, obviously, the hamstring is one of the most key components of a soccer player, just, from the leg standpoint and running and cutting. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So human movement, especially soccer players, it's very triplanar, meaning you're moving forward, back, side to side, rotationally. There's a lot going on, especially like, for example, in a cut or a plant. If you don't have the basic sagittal plane muscles like a hamstring to load your body weight, because think of it this way. So when you take a step forward, your heel strikes the ground, and this is just normal gait I'm talking about here, and I'll relate it to soccer in a second. But when you take a step forward, your heel strikes the ground and your pelvis should be pulled back, because that is a loading movement when you start to load your body weight onto that side that you just stepped forward with. So when your pelvis is pulled back by that hamstring, that should allow you to properly load your body weight onto that side. But if we don't have our hamstrings in a good position, if we don't have the ability to load our body weight to one side with our hamstring, then our quad could take over, our hip flexor could take over. We could have a variety of things go wrong. But essentially, that hamstring is going to be the first thing that pretty much needs to fire to pull your pelvis back so that you can load your body weight onto that side effectively. Now imagine, let's go to like a soccer plant, even though that's like a, that's kind of like a frontal plane, a side to side action, or even like some rotational components going on there. If you were to plant on the ground and that hamstring can't kick on, then you're going to have to find a way to slow yourself down. You're going to have to find a way to load your body weight in the most effective strategy that your body has. And that could be a big problem, because then we could start to compensate. Things could start to go wrong. And then all of a sudden your knee turns in too much because you don't have stability through your pelvis, and then your ACL is gone.
Right. What are some common, grades of different injuries that you can get with the hamstring?
So you see hamstring strains quite a bit. And there's obviously different grades of them, but a lot of them are like relatively minor and they heal within a couple of weeks. But when it comes to hamstring problems, I'm probably going to assess the pelvis, because that's what's going to tell me what's going on with that hamstring. So if I assess someone's pelvis and on the side of their injury, their pelvis is very far forward, then that would be an indication that perhaps, not always, but oftentimes, that person's hamstring is in a lengthened position. So it is unable to effectively contract to load that person's body weight onto their respective side where they're taking a step forward. So when they strike the ground with that foot, that hamstring that's in a lengthened position can't effectively fire. So it could perhaps stretch out even longer, or it could just not even stabilize the pelvis in the first place. And then there's excessive stress on a muscle that's already lengthened out. So that tends to be how these injuries occur. And in order to fix these injuries, it's important to address the pelvis itself by bringing it back to more of a quote unquote neutral orientation, where it's not too far forward, where that water is spilling out the front. It can be brought back. And then therefore it has the ability to go forward and back, because if it's always stuck forward, then we're keeping our hamstring in one orientation and it lacks the variability to go forward and back. And you can kind of see how that would be problematic.
Are there a lot of differences between a youth player and an adult player when it comes to the hamstring?
That's a really good question. I would say when you're younger, it's easier to fix these things, because you don't have decades or multiple decades or just like a couple of years of being stuck in whatever pattern that you're stuck in. So the older you get, the more you tend to want to stick with what you're comfortable with, because you've been molded by your lifestyle, by the demands of your sport, by the demands of your training. And if all of that is reflecting a pelvic position that is forward, because that's the easiest way for you to move, then it can be a lot harder to make changes that last in those people. It's not impossible. It's definitely possible. But like if you have a, 13-year-old female soccer player who has a hamstring strain, then that's going to be probably a much easier fix than someone who is in their mid-30s and has been playing soccer for a very long time. And these patterns are just very ingrained into their movement, into their brain, and into the muscles themselves.
I think one thing that goes, I don't know what the word, I guess it, a lot of people don't think about it. I know I thought about it with my children when they were younger, was getting them involved with a strength and conditioning coach. And the only reason I truly believe when we started out doing that was to get them so that they are moving properly, they are moving smartly, and it reduces their risk of injury. It lessens it. I really believe that my daughter, she's a soccer player, and I believe that her strength and conditioning coach is a huge reason why her injuries have been limited over the number of years since she started. You know, she started going to him, I think, when she was 13. And I really believe that. Can you talk to us just a little bit? And I know some people kind of get on my case a little bit. Oh, you're just out there promoting the strength and conditioning community and stuff like that. It's like, but, you know, if you've got an athlete that is serious about wanting to play at the next level, you know, wanting to go on to college to play like my daughter's going to do this fall and that kind of thing. I really think it's an important talk. I mean, just talk to us a little bit about how important that strength and conditioning coach is.
Absolutely. So I'm biased, obviously, because I am a strength and conditioning coach, but it, even with that into consideration, it just makes so much sense. Like, why wouldn't you want to do it? Because A, most of your competition probably is, especially as you get more advanced and higher into like more competitive environments. And B, the science is just overwhelmingly positive in the direction of doing strength and conditioning on a regular basis, even in season. There is just a plethora. I can't even like begin to tell you, like, injury prevention, faster speed, better intermuscular coordination, where the muscles are better able to fire when the demands that you've trained them to fire are present in the environment. So that means, like, if you train someone how to train someone, like, through maximal strength, which is something a lot of people are afraid of, like, you don't want to lift heavy weights, especially with females. And that's just so far from the case of reality, because when you have an individual that doesn't know how to fire their muscles in the right order because they haven't put the demands on their body to where they know how to do that, then when you go and, like, you plant into the ground, then, like, that 7-8 times your body weight going into the ground, like, that requires a very high degree of force production and absorption, and the best way to train that is through external loads in the weight room. So there's nothing to be afraid of. If you have a trainer that has absolutely no idea what they're doing, then that could be problematic, but look for someone that's certified, look for someone that has a good track record, and that's probably a good way to go. And you don't really want to work with someone who's like a weekend warrior who, you know, took a weekend course and that's all they have for experience. Like, obviously do your research. And if you do, then you're probably going to be totally fine. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it just makes way too much sense in terms of what the literature says, in terms of what the competition is doing, and just in terms of, like, how it affects the way your muscles can fire on the field. It's just, I think it's a total no-brainer.
And it's something that my daughter's strength and conditioning coach said to me early on in our conversations, because, I mean, I went and interviewed a number of them in the area just to kind of see what their thoughts were before I even brought her into the equation. And the one that she trains with now told me that, you know, you can be as talented as all get out, but how valuable are you if you're not available? You know, meaning that, you know, you're injured all the time and that kind of thing.
Right.
So, and you know, you bring up a really good point in your answer, and I want to go down this rabbit hole just a little bit. If you were a parent and you know, you have a son or a daughter that wants to compete at the next level. I mean, they want to play in college, you know, they want to play on that elite team or whatever, that type of thing. What questions would you ask a potential certified strength and conditioning coach before you went to that person?
That is a fantastic question. I would ask them what their experience is, first of all, because, like I said, if they just got a weekend certification and they're running camps, which is unfortunately all too common, then that's probably not a good sign. I would say, what is your experience? What levels of athletes have you worked with? How long have you been doing it for? And do you have any data that can show me, like, objectively, like, test, retest, show me that you can actually get results? Because there's so many programs out there where you can put your kid in it, pay whatever fee, and then you have absolutely no idea if this person got better or not. So I think it's important that they test, they retest, and they have some sort of protocol to where it's objective. It's not like subjective, like, yeah, your athlete's definitely running faster now, I could see it on the field. Like, well, how do you know? You know, so there's got to be I think those are the big things you want to hit, because these concepts can be complicated. And as a strength and conditioning coach, I do not expect at all the parents to fully understand what I'm doing. But if I have data that's easy to understand, and it's like, hey, you know, like, this is their vertical jump before and after, this is their 20-40 yard dash, and this is their agility test, and they got better, well, then not only is that going to help me as a coach bring that person back next time, but it's going to give the parents confidence that these programs actually work.
And one of the things that I like about my daughter's strength and conditioning coach, he talks to us talks to, I mean, not only me, but also talks to my daughter a little bit more, because honestly, she's interested in going, when she goes off to college, she's going to be majoring in sports studies. And, you know, when she comes out, like, you know, she'll be able to go get, become a certified strength and conditioning coach, that kind of thing. She has a lot of interest. Ever since she started doing it, you know, you could see the her eyes light up of learning about different things about her body and discovering, you know, different loading patterns and that kind of thing. Going back a little bit to the hamstring issues, what can athletes do and parents do? I mean, other than going to a strength and conditioning coach to kind of work on their hamstrings, I mean, what are some things?
Something that they can do is they can think about how they hold themselves up. I don't want to give people too much to think about, but I would say, if they notice that their weight is very far on their toes throughout the day, like you see girls, especially like teenage girls, I see this a lot with them. They like to stand on their toes, and it's just a comfortable way for them to stand for whatever reason. But unfortunately, when your center of mass is so forward like that, that pushes that pelvis bowl forward where the water starts to spill out a lot. So if someone is in that orientation for a very long time, then that is going to lengthen out that hamstring, and that's going to put it under a lot of stress and a long stretch. So again, going back to how that could be problematic, we want the hamstring to be able to contract, relax, because ultimately, like, every muscle needs to have a degree of slack. And when that hamstring is lengthened out all the way, all the time, then there's no slack for that muscle to be able to contract and relax. So I would encourage people throughout the day to find their heels. When they're sitting, find their sit bones, those two bony protrusions in each butt cheek. When you're sitting, find those, because that's going to put your pelvis in probably a pretty good orientation. And if you ever do feel like your pelvis is very, very far forward, I would encourage people also to look up on Google a 90-90 hip lift, like we talked about the first time I was on this podcast, and look at how they do it. Look at how they're breathing through it. And that's a really good way. You know, a good alternative to a hamstring stretch is quite the opposite, is to turn the hamstring on, because that's going to help pull that pelvis back. That's going to ultimately help take stress off of the hamstring. But the most important thing of that exercise is we need to be able to breathe through it slowly and effectively. And because if we're tight and we're trying to make a change to our body, if we're stressed out, if we're treating it like a max strength exercise, then we're just upregulating our system. We're just getting jacked up, right? We're not actually allowing our body to relax, breathing through it, feeling the obliques, because the obliques are the other muscle that works with the hamstrings in order to help pull that pelvis back, except it's just on the front side of your body. But due to the attachment sites, if you can exhale all the way while doing a 90-90 hip lift, and then you can feel those side abs turn on, then that's going to further help bring that pelvis back to a more natural and neutral orientation.
All right. So we have a situation where players running down the field, and you see that all familiar sight. They're running. Suddenly they kind of stop a little bit and they grab the back of their leg. What advice do you have of the next steps for that athlete?
Yeah, so obviously they're going to need some time, because there's trauma to those tissues, whether or not it's just a little bit or it's significant. Regardless, like, that person is going to need to rest. And I would say, like, there's a lot of conflicting data about ice, so I don't really want to give an opinion one way or the other, but I don't think I would recommend ice to everyone in these situations, because there's some indication and information that ice inhibits the natural healing processes of the body, because it basically shuts down blood flow to that area, which is counterintuitive to what most people think it does over the long term. So I don't think ice is a big thing. I think what I would do with someone right away is I would find a way to have, well, assuming they've rested and they're starting to feel a little bit better, I would do a couple of things to help bring their center of mass back. And that's probably beyond the scope of this podcast. But Essentially, I want to help them feel their heels all the time. I want to make sure that that water is in front of the bowl so much. So another thing that do if the hamstring is too painful to do something like a 90-90 hip lift is you could do something like all four breathing, where you are basically in a quadruped position and you're rounding your back ever so slightly. You're mostly like retracting your rib cage. And if anyone wants to know what that looks like, I actually sent a tweet out about that just today. And essentially, if you can bring your center of mass back through breathing into your posterior rib cage, then you're going to allow people to expand air, and that's going to naturally push them back. And then if they can feel those obliques contract on the exhale, then that is going to allow that pelvis to come back to a more neutral state without necessarily have to going directly over after the hamstrings, because there are instances when you have an individual that has a hamstring strain or a hamstring injury, and I can't do a 90-90 hip lift with them because that is just going to irritate their trauma. So I need to bring their pelvis back in another way through another muscle that would help do that. And for everyone, that is the obliques on the front side of the body. They have the same sort of joint action as the hamstrings, but they serve an obviously a much different function through respiration, through breathing. That's why we have them in this quadruped position where they're feeling their back rib cage expand, which is ultimately going to help bring their center of mass back as well.
One thing I want to, I want you to, since you're the expert, I want you to reiterate to our audience. One of my biggest pet peeves is coming back from some sort of injury issue too soon, just because there's a big game coming up, or, you know, the scout is going to be there and watching this and that kind of thing. Talk to us just and tell us parents, you know, coming back from a hamstring injury too soon and the complications that come with that.
Yeah. So if that hamstring is strained, it's obviously strained for a reason, probably at least in part due to the concepts that we're talking about today. But if you go and you put a muscle that is essentially traumatized under another stress, and running is so, soccer especially, there's so much force that the hamstrings are under when you're running, when you're sprinting, when you're cutting, when you're planting your foot, that we have to understand that the risk versus reward. Like, think of it this way. You can go and send your athlete out there. It might work out, it might not. But let's say it doesn't work out. Then think of the cost-benefit analysis of doing that. You are essentially putting that athlete out there, and then if they hurt themselves again, then you're looking at double, just as a general idea, the time that it's going to take them to heal from the first injury, because now you've made it probably a lot worse, and you just lost all that time you spent rehabbing the injury in the first place. And then you're going to have to spend time getting that athlete back up to speed, because they've lost time from the first injury, and now they're going to lose even more time, and a lot more time probably, in the second injury, because now you really have to be careful. So really, it's like it's like if you take a month off, it's going to take you probably at least a couple of weeks to a month to get back into the swing of things and get your confidence back. Or you could just sit them out probably another week, week and a half, and then not take that risk.
If you could just give, as we kind of wrap things up here, if you could just give one piece of advice for our listening audience about hamstrings, what would that one thing you leave them with?
Ooh, that's a good one. I would say spend some time at the beginning, at least, and hopefully also the end of each training session, working on feeling the proximal, meaning closer to the pelvis fibers of your hamstring. And if you can do that, that's probably going to set your pelvis up for a better neutral orientation throughout the rest of your soccer game, throughout the rest of your training session, throughout the rest of whatever. And if you do that consistently enough, then your body is going to get the message you're trying to send it, which is, hey, let's not have this pelvis be in potentially such a detrimental and risky, for lack of a better term, orientation. So, I don't like to make things black and white, and I don't like to make like blank statements, but really you can't go wrong if you were to give someone something like one of these 90-90 hip lift drills, something like one of those quadruped breathing exercises. It really, like, I've worked with so many athletes and they all kind of default into the same positions. And if they've compensated on top of that, it can look different. But really, every human being tends to start to compensate in very similar and predictable ways. So if you were to give that to any athlete and make sure they're doing it right, because if they're just not doing it correctly or they're rushing through it, then you're not going to get any of the benefits of it. But if the intention is right, if the breathing is right, if they're feeling the right things, then I think that is probably the easiest thing everyone could start doing right now to help prevent these injuries from happening.
For those that know, Connor is a wonderful follow on Twitter and also Instagram. A lot of valuable content that he's putting out there. Where can they find, if they don't know, where can they find you on Twitter and Instagram?
Sure. So my handle is at Connor, C-O-N-O-R, underscore Harris, H-A-R-R-I-S, and then another underscore after that. That's for both Twitter and Instagram.
And we'll make sure to go ahead and tag you in all of our posts that we had, like we've done last time. And like I said, if you do not follow Connor, he's a wonderful follow and lots of information. He actually did a question and answer session on his Instagram story either last night or the night before or something like that. It was a wonderful opportunity for people to ask questions, and Connor answered them for you. And so I highly recommend you go out there and follow Connor. Connor, thank you so much for coming back on the program, once again providing valuable information to the membership of the West Virginia Soccer Association. Thank you so much.
Of course. Thanks for having me. I hope to be back.
And thank you for listening to the West Virginia Soccer Association Beyond the Pitch podcast here on the West Virginia Soccer Association Digital Network. Now that you've heard our show, make sure you give our podcast a 5-star rating and follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next Thursday with another episode, so we hope to see you next week. Take care.